The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This week on the podcast, I have an extra special guest. Her name is Jean Hynes, and she is the incoming CEO of Wellington Management, a nearly 100-year-old firm which manages over $1 trillion in assets. Jean is a fascinating investor. She's got a great history, both as she started her early jobs at Wellington, eventually taking over the Vanguard Healthcare Fund, the largest healthcare fund in the country. As a managing partner at Wellington and soon to be CEO, she simply has a unique perspective as to what's going on in the world of asset management. That includes everything from governance issues, who's becoming CEOs, who's rising up through the ranks across the entire industry, what the impact of sustainability is going to be on the entire asset management. We talk about private equity. We talk about passive versus active. Pretty much we covered everything there was to discuss about investing these days. And really, there aren't many people who have as unique a perch to look out on the world of finance and have an informed opinion. I thought this was a fascinating conversation, and I think you will too. So with no further ado, my interview of Wellington Management's Jean Hynes.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
My extra special guest this week is Jean Hynes. She is the incoming CEO of Wellington Asset Management. The firm manages over $1 trillion in client assets. She began as an administrative assistant at Wellington and currently also manages the $51 billion Vanguard Healthcare Fund, the country's largest healthcare fund. She takes over as CEO this June. Jean Hynes, welcome to Bloomberg.
Thank you very much, Barry. I'm happy to talk to you today.
So I'm kind of intrigued by all sorts of parts of your career. You come out of a college with a degree in economics, but your first job is as an administrative assistant. Seems a little disconnected. Explain that early career choice.
Well, Barry, if I go back and maybe just give you some context, you know, I'm a daughter of Irish immigrants. And so when I went to Wellesley College on a scholarship, I didn't really know anything about the stock market. And I remember being in the crash of 87. That was my first experience in hearing about what the stock market did. I took a sociology class and it was about work. And so you had to find an internship at a place of work anywhere around Boston. And I found an internship at a brokerage firm. And that introduced me to the market, which I loved. And I particularly liked the research part of it. I wanted to find out what made stocks go up and down. And so in the context of 1991, which was a mini recession, if you remember, there weren't many jobs. I went out trying to find that job where I could learn about the markets and do research. I was interviewing at two different jobs. They were similar jobs. One had a much better title, and one, the one at Wellington, was an administrative assistant. And you have to imagine back in 1991, Wellington was under 300 employees. We're 2,700 now, so it was much smaller organization, very flat. I didn't know I was going to come in and do maybe 50% of my job would be more typical research assistant work. And I remember back to the headhunter telling me that this is a special place. You're never going to regret going to Wellington. There's going to be lots of growth opportunities for you, and that's why I took the job. And I guess I really did for the first couple of years. Maybe 50% of the job was administrative. 50% was really getting to know the markets and learning how to model. And then about 18 months in, I started working with Ed Owens.
So let's talk a little bit about Ed Owens. He has been called the best investor you never heard of. He ran the Vanguard Healthcare Fund for quite a long time. What did you learn from working with Ed?
I've had the privilege of working for Ed for 20 years of my career. When I think back, and as I said, I started working with Ed in early 1993, and that was a period of intense IPO activity in the biotechnology sector. He was the biotech analyst. He was the pharmaceutical analyst, and he also ran the Vanguard Healthcare Fund. And so I just got to go deep with him right from the very beginning. When we started working together. If I had to take a step back and say, what are the three things that Ed taught me that sort of live with me now and how I both show up as an investor and show up as a leader, I think one, just the concept of very deep research. You know, when we're thinking about how we're going to make money for our clients, it's, you know, what will the future hold? What will change that is going to really create value for the world? And I think Ed was early in taking that perspective. I think the other one was also following all companies, any market cap, global. I think he was global before many investors were global. And that really helped us build mosaics. So for instance, if a company was working on a specific mechanism of action for a drug, and there was a small company in San Diego working on it, there might be a Japanese company also working on it. And that just helped us flesh out what was happening and really helped us figure out who might be the winners and whether this was really going to be a drug. Was this really going to change medicine? And so I think that sort of deep research Ed instilled in me. Secondly, it's just, what value is. So, you know, Ed is a value investor. I consider myself a value investor. And that is very much linked to trying to see what the future is. So what is this company going to be worth if this drug is successful or they gain this market share in this medical device? And it's not necessarily a low P type of investing. It's really what companies are worth. And then just really tying that to what the stock is at. So our job is not to predict the future of medicine. Our job is to buy stocks, not concepts. So where is that value versus fundamental? And there has to be room in the value of the enterprise for us to make money for our clients. And just finally, flexibility. Ed was a very long-term, low-turnover investor, but he was anything but complacent. He was just very flexible to change his mind when something changed our long-term thesis. I think I'm much better at that in the past decade. I think that's something you learn over time. I think it's a very important in my leadership as well as we think about the firm. That sort of flexibility is very key.
So I want to flesh out some of the results from that approach to investing in healthcare with some numbers. When Ed retired in 2012, the Vanguard Healthcare Fund that he was managing was the top performing fund over the previous 25 years. Over 3,000% for an annualized return of more than 14.8%, far ahead of its benchmark or the S&P 500. So what sort of pressure was it like taking over a fund that had those sort of numbers?
Well, I worked with Ed, as I said, for 20 years on that fund. So I was very closely tied to the research as well as some of my colleagues on the team. So I guess when I took over the fund, I just felt very comfortable that we had built a team and we had learned from Ed. We had the privilege of learning from Ed for 20 years, that we would make him proud and carry on carry on the great results over the long term that he has created. I would say a couple of things as well. For over 25 years, he really brought that very science-based, long-term bet. You know, healthcare is a growth industry. I think it will continue to be a growth industry going forward. And so that is, you know, really bringing that lens to the fund. He was also very much a contrarian and again, this value investor. And, you know, when you think back to big moves in the index, you know, he had made a big move in 99 and 2000 towards healthcare services and medical technology, which had been very much out of favor for many years. And that was, say, 20-25% of the index back in 99 and 2000. Now it's closer to 50%. So that shift to looking broader than just the pharmaceutical companies also, you know, served us well during that period.
Really interesting. And in 2014, you became one of Wellington's three managing partners. What has that experience been like, knowing that you're the key troika that's responsible for directing over $1 trillion?
So one of Wellington's core edges is our private partnership structure, and that structure has been in place now for almost 42 years. It's gone global. It's scaled up to $1 trillion. And I would say, you know, the concepts of the private partnership structure have been in place now for 40 plus years. The three managing partners are responsible for the governance of the partnership. And I guess now, after in my seventh year of being a managing partner, I just really appreciate, you know, one, the brilliance of our partnership structure, the fact that, you know, the partners and the employees need to trust us to do our homework and leave our biases behind. So again, when I think about my last 7 years, I've just learned so much about the business. The managing partner role, it's about people becoming partners and becoming managing directors, and it's about sharing the economics of the firm. And so, again, those two things about being very fair, knowing the business so you can make the right decisions, are things that have helped me be one of those managing partners that our partners trust.
Quite interesting.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you're here as in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
So let's talk a little bit about Wellington. I know they have a big birthday coming up, soon to be 100 years old. Having that sort of history, what does that mean to the firm?
So our 100-year anniversary is still a few years off. We trace our roots back to 1928, when Walter Morgan founded the first balanced mutual fund, which is now the Wellington Fund, that is sponsored by Vanguard. Our modern history of the firm is almost 42 years old, when we formed our private partnership and took the company from being a public company to being a private partnership back in 1979.
And the firm currently is running over $1 trillion in client assets. Tell us about some of your clients. I know that pensions and endowments and foundations, as well as other global wealth managers, are some of the clients of Wellington.
So what we do one thing at Wellington, and that's manage money for our clients. We have a large sub-advisory business in the U.S. and around the world. We have a very large institutional business, and that's from governments around the world to pension funds to endowments and foundations. We, as you mentioned, we have a growing private wealth business for private banks. Again, our singular focus is on providing investment content, investment products. I think that singular focus really helps us deliver investment excellence over time for our clients around the world.
So one of your largest clients is Vanguard. That's a long-standing relationship. Obviously, Jack Bogle came out of Wellington to launch Vanguard. Tell us about the relationship between Wellington Management and the Vanguard Group.
So Barry, as you said, Vanguard and Wellington had very similar roots back in 1928 when Walter Morgan founded the company. And we went different paths in the 1970s, with Wellington focused on investment management and investment content, and Vanguard focusing on the mutual fund distribution business. I would say we have a very, very strong partnership. They are our largest client. And I just have enormous respect for how well they've done as a business. Our goal with Vanguard is to really make sure that we're delivering investment excellence over over the long term. And I would say one of the things that I really appreciate about Vanguard is they really have a very long-term horizon. And they are evaluating us on 5 years and 10 years. And I think that sort of partnership has served us well over time.
Huh. Interesting. You mentioned earlier that Wellington is a partnership, not publicly traded. I have to imagine that over time, there were offers to either go public or to be sold. Why stay private? What's the advantage of that?
So one of the most important advantages of staying private is that we can be very long-term in our investment horizons, long-term in how we evaluate our talent. And that really does align with the long-term objectives of our clients. So what are we trying to do? We are trying to deliver investment results, investment outcomes for our clients, and ultimately their end beneficiaries, which could be retail individual investors around the world. It could be pensioners, and they have their time horizons are extremely long-term. And so again, I think our private partnership serves us quite well, and it might be the optimal structure to run an investment asset management business. And I would say the other thing is that this is not a capital-heavy business, so we don't rely on the financial markets or banks to run our business. And so again, there was never any necessity. And then maybe one final thing is that we have grown organically. Since I started in 1991, we were approximately $60 billion, and as you said, we're over $1 trillion now. That's all been through organic growth, adding talent along the way to globalize or grow our fixed income business. And again, we haven't needed, we now have it at our size, we have the global scale to invest in our business without relying on the market.
So tell us a little bit about the firm's morning meeting. It's been described as a, quote, signature event. Tell us a little bit about that.
So the morning meeting has been going on since 1958. It is something that has started in our Boston office, but now also happens. We have a Eurasia morning meeting that happens in our London, and that connects to our Asia offices. It's really a place to get together and debate what's happening in the markets, whether that's individual stocks or individual credits or individual or what's happening on a macro level. It really does bring the firm together in terms of a focus on how, you know, the news of the day. Sometimes those meetings are very topical, and sometimes they are forward looking, and we try to share unfinished ideas. I think most importantly, Barry, if I could leave you with one thing about our firm, is that we have a very collaborative culture. And what that means is that there's no chief investment officer. Each individual portfolio manager, we have about 50 plus boutiques, can go back and practice their own philosophy and process. But we have this open collaborative platform. The morning meeting is critical part of that. And what you want is debate and challenge on any topic. And I think the morning meeting has allowed that forum where portfolio managers and analysts can have debates and have different views and different perspectives. I think that has really helped our collaborative platform.
And you mentioned attracting talent. What has it been like this year to attract or develop and retain talent, given the challenges of the pandemic and having to work remotely, not necessarily being able to interview people face to face? What's it been like this past year?
We have attracted. So again, as you said, it's surprising how, you know, we're almost a year into really having to work from home, and we've been able to run the firm virtually, and that includes attracting talent from all over the globe. So we have onboarded well over 100 people in 2020 and even more starting in 21. And so that has seemed seamless. But again, the most important thing is how do you integrate them and how do you integrate them into your teams? We've had two new team members on the healthcare team. So I know firsthand we're trying to integrate them into our processes and into our team culture. And again, I think it takes work. It takes work to make sure that you're connecting and you're getting to know them and that you're spending a lot of time with them. I think the apprenticeship model is one of the things that we will, as we think about the future of work, that will be very important to having in-person, both the combination of both in-person and potentially more flexibility in the future. But again, we've tried a lot of different things to make sure we are both integrating new talent as well as keeping teams together during this pandemic. And technology has really helped. And it's really a lot of every day making sure people are connecting, either through our morning meeting, as we talked about, or through more team meetings or through one-on-one conversations.
So you're founded in Philadelphia, headquartered in Boston. How has the pandemic changed how you recruit and retain people? Does it open up more opportunities?
I do think what we've learned from working from home is that, you know, one, the technology works, so we can work more virtually, and we can be more flexible in terms of how we use technology to interact. So I would suspect, first of all, there will be more flexibility in the workforce, and that does allow us to think about other locations where we can attract talent. So other parts of the U.S. where we don't have offices, that's something we're looking at. No decisions have been made, but that's something that I would suspect we'll look at over time, as well as other parts of the world where we don't have offices. Like how do we take a fresh look? We have a group of our leaders now studying. We have a business challenge studying the future of work. I think in the next couple of months we'll see what's there, and they've done such extensive work in terms of surveying other companies and surveying our employees, and I think they'll come with recommendations about, you know, how we'll work in the future, and I assume we'll have more flexibility, and that will allow us to think more broadly about where our employees are located.
So what's going on, Jean, in the healthcare industry today? What insights do we have on the vaccine and innovation? This has really been a hell of a year for healthcare.
Yes, Barry. I think when you think about healthcare, and I did mention earlier that healthcare is a growth industry. And what I mean by that is that when you think about demand with the population aging, as well as in many emerging markets such as China, more people entering the middle class, that just increases healthcare demand. So healthcare demand is increasing at a brisk rate, and then we have payers around the world, you know, try to figure out how to control that natural growth of healthcare. So that's what's on the demand side. I think on the supply side, we are in, and I really like to say, we are in a revolutionary period of biology. And so when you talk about the biopharmaceutical side of healthcare, this is the most exciting period in my 25 plus years of following the industry. And I think in 2020, that technology, the power of that technology, really came through when you think about how fast the vaccines and the antibodies and, you know, how fast they were able to be developed during this pandemic.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum, powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
So last year, mRNA was the new tech. It really showed its stuff in developing the COVID vaccine. What are some of the next great healthcare technologies? When are the nanobots going to eat the cholesterol that's built up in people's vascular systems, or is it something else entirely?
Yeah, I think if we take a step back and think about the history of biopharmaceuticals, and you had small molecule drugs, those are small drugs like, you know, Advil or aspirin, and then in the 1990s you had the discovery of that you could deliver proteins, and in the late 1990s you had the discovery that you could deliver monoclonal antibodies, which went after much larger receptors in the body. That just opened up biology. So again, when you think about the past 20 years, it's been the growth in the industry and really being able to treat many different diseases has been about using these biologics to treat diseases. I think we're in a completely new era now in 2020 when you think about the ability to target DNA in a completely new way. So we think about the history of all medicines, those three modalities, and now we have small interfering RNA, as you mentioned, messenger RNA, gene therapy, eventually CRISPR. We have new modalities called bispecific antibodies, which target two targets at once. And even small molecules, because you understand biology at a completely new level, small molecules are becoming more targeted with less side effects. And so when you look forward to the next 20 years, as we unravel biology, we're just going to have many, many more modalities. I'm not sure if we're going to have nanobots, but I do think that these technology platforms will be used broadly across all diseases to treat diseases. And I think if we look back 20, 30 years from now, we will have made a substantial inroads into disease and treating disease. And that's very exciting and encouraging and will create a lot of value for the industry.
What about oncology and cancer? We've seen a lot of progress, but it turns out cancer is not one disease, but hundreds of diseases. What are we looking at in that space, and how important is genomics for pursuing a broader cure for cancer?
So when you think back to 10 years ago, cancer was treated with chemotherapy, which are like poisons, and chemotherapy really has resulted in, you know, really controlling cancer or helping to treat cancer. But it's been the past 10 years where you've had the ability to use genomics and use genetic information to both understand why cancers grow. And like you said, it's, you know, breast cancer or lung cancer is not just because it's in the lung doesn't mean it's being driven by the same kinds of mutations. And so just a better understanding of why patients, what's driving their cancers has led to a much better identification of targets and much better identification of drugs. And so when you think about cancer now, you still have chemotherapy as a backbone. You have immuno-oncology, which helps the immune system overcome the cancers. And you have targeted therapies in terms of driver mutations, the ability to target those driver mutations. I think in the future, some of the interesting areas are going to be antibody drug conjugates, which is more precisely delivering chemo through an antibody. Those platforms, I think, will expand going forward. You have, you know, they're the first of CAR Ts. I think those could possibly be used much more broadly in other diseases as well. So I think we're on the brink of really making dramatic changes in oncology. And interestingly, when you look at the industry, when you look at the biotechnology industry, I think half the companies are oncology based, and wow, approximately half of R&D spending in the industry is oncology. So when you think about the combination of really unmet medical need and being very susceptible or driven by genetic mutations, that's the perfect marriage in terms of really making progress.
Quite interesting. So what does this mean for longevity and future lifespans? Are we looking at someone being born today with a high probability of reaching 100?
I would suspect that lifespans are going to be prolonged going forward. I think you're already seeing that. I think that just recently the death rate from cancer has declined in the last 5 years. We just talked about the number of new technologies, so you're already seeing it in the data. So that would be one. I think that also the ability to have gene therapy for these 100 monogenic diseases that potentially could be susceptible to a technology like gene therapy, that if you give those to newborns, that could dramatically change the lifespan and the quality of the lifespan of individuals with those genetic mutations. So that would be another area. And I think when you think about the large parts of the market that really drive mortality, you know, really, really it's cancer and it's also cardiovascular disease. And
right.
I think we've made progress in terms of congestive heart failure and blood pressure. And so, again, if we can crack those and you have more people at an earlier stage controlling all of those risk factors, that will also likely lead to longer lives in the future.
Huh, quite interesting. So let's talk a little bit about Wellington. I think of you guys as an investor in the public spaces, but you have a pretty robust business in alternative assets like private equity and venture capital. I think that's over $30 billion now. Tell us a little bit about what's attractive in that space.
So we have an over $30 billion in alternatives, which are both long short funds as well as an emerging private equity business. If I think about the private equity business, we and you mentioned that we were a public company. One of the things that we started, you know, right around 2014 to 2015 is launching a late stage crossover fund. So that was our first private fund. It, you know, came out of the observation that companies were staying private longer and there weren't as many IPOs, and it was a very natural adjacency to our public investing. We've just launched the third of that platform, and a few years ago we also launched the first of a biology-based private fund. Again, I think the big observation when you step back is that there are more companies staying private longer. There are more companies that are private. When I think about biotechnology, there are more private companies relative to public companies now than at any part in my career. So it is a very ripe area for investing, and it really is very much aligned with how we invest in the public market. It's very adjacent to our public market investing. And I think if you think about Wellington going forward, we'll have more platforms beyond those first two. It's an area that we're investing in as a firm.
So some of the other alternatives that are out there, hedge funds seem to have gotten very crowded over the past 20 years. And some people have argued the same is true for the venture capital side. A lot of money is chasing only a finite amount of deals. What does the risk look like in private equity? Is there the possibility that that becomes a crowded space also?
I'll go back to what I talked about in terms of the number of private companies. So again, when we think about our process and think about Wellington's very rooted process in terms of both valuation and assessing fundamentals, I think we think there is plenty of opportunity right now for using our skills as public investors, using the skills we've generated, skills we've honed over many, many years to apply those to the private market. And I think the observation about maybe the productivity of the world, that there are just a number of private, you know, a larger number of private companies than probably any time in history, and creating real value for the world. And that's the opportunity.
Huh, really interesting. Let's talk a little bit about sustainable investing. Wellington is known for its sustainability and alternatives approaches. You guys have a partnership with Woodwell Climate Research Center. What are some of the physical effects of climate change on capital markets? How is climate change affecting asset prices?
So let me take a step back and talk about sustainability and then talk about our Woodwell Climate Research partnership and then how it impacts the market.
Sure.
In terms of sustainability, it's broad, if you think about ESG, environment, social, and governance, I think governance has been, an important part of our process for the past 25 years. Governance has always been an important part of our process. Now, we now define it more, and we are interacting as a firm more with companies as well as boards in terms of our oversight of governance of our holdings, and I think that will continue. I think in the last number of years, the environmental has really become quite important in terms of, you know, new regulations being put in place in certain parts of the world. And again, we have this very exciting partnership with Woodwell Climate Research Center, and we're working with a few of our clients on this partnership, and we're asking questions such as, how does climate impact asset prices. And there's just been fascinating insights into how water shortage, for example, or heat maps. So we're bringing that climate research down to very specific parts of geographies and then connecting them and trying to connect them then to, well, this business is in this geography and is that going to have an impact potentially on municipal bonds, for example, or even on the equities in the medium to long term. So that what we're trying to do is take those insights, make sure we're asking the right questions, take those insights and bring it down to very specific mapping of climate risk, and then trying to connect that to actual stocks and credits. And so we are in the process of doing that. It's a very exciting partnership. And we're also doing, with that data, doing climate reviews of our portfolios. So again, what do our portfolios look like from a climate perspective? If I take a very big step back, I think the next stage will be social. You know, again, how does social interact with the public markets? And I would suspect, Barry, that we are going, that sustainability is not a fad. It's here to stay. And it is really going to impact how the markets evolve in terms of where assets go into what kind of funds. And so that, it's a very important area of investment for Wellington in terms of, you know, both talent, in terms of the talent that comes with ESG background, as well as a technology investment for us in terms of how we can use our climate, for example, or our governance insights into portfolio construction. I think we're early in the process, but eventually it will become part of the dialogue of all stocks.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Number of years.
So in June, you take over for Brendan Swords as Wellington's fifth CEO since the firm went private in 1979. You're the first woman to serve in that capacity. You're only one of two female CEOs amongst the largest asset managers. What does this tell us about governance as an issue, both in corporate America generally, but in the finance sector specifically?
So I'm going to answer that in two parts. One would be very Wellington specific, and then maybe one about a comment about corporate, you know, the world of corporations and what the future might hold. From a Wellington perspective, as you said, I'm going to be the fifth generation CEO of the private partnership era since 1979. I think the most important thing to know is we really value stewardship. We really value passing the baton to the next generation, leaving the partnership in a better place. Like, my goal is that this partnership and this firm will be thriving 50 years from now. So that's very important in terms of, that's a very Wellington-specific stewardship of the firm. If I shift and think about governance, you know, I just have an observation. I think it is a novelty now that as a female becoming a CEO, and it's very exciting to see a number of peers in the industry and in other industries becoming CEOs. Hopefully it will be a novelty. It won't be such a novelty in 10 years. And the observation I'm going to make, it's an observation based on seeing what's happening in the healthcare industry and seeing broader data, is that I do think as more women in all industries have more experience running parts of the business, we are going to see more females become CEOs, and hopefully 10 years from now there'll be a lot more deserving women who have had the opportunity to run businesses being prepared to be CEOs of corporations around the world. You know, when I think about myself being a managing partner that we talked about earlier, that really provided me that experience for me. It really broadened my perspective, and I got to know the firm and got to know both the clients and the firm and the talent throughout the organization that has helped me prepare for the next for the upcoming succession from Brendan.
That's quite interesting. So over the past, let's call it decade or so, certainly since the great financial crisis, we've seen a lot of assets flow towards passive. You guys seem to have done pretty well as an active manager. What are you doing to compete more effectively against passive? Is that going to be an ongoing shift, or is this eventually going to reach some form of equilibrium?
I strongly believe there's a very important place for active management. There's also a very important place for passive. It's our job at Wellington, being an active manager, and that is our strategy going forward. How do we help our clients achieve their investment outcomes? And when you think about our clients, and again, back to what are we trying to do for clients? We're trying to help them with their future liabilities, or you know, how do they fund their pension funds, for example, or how do people retire with more assets so they can live a fulfilling retirement. That's what we're trying to do. And we believe that if we can deliver investment excellence, that the alpha part of the equation will become even more important going forward. So when you think about where interest rates are, what is the outlook for bond returns going forward when interest rates are, close to zero, with the equity markets, having a strong run for the past 12 years, we think alpha will become an even more important part of the outcomes for our clients. And so, again, that's our number one focus, investment excellence. We can deliver alpha to our clients. We will do well and help them solve their problems and hopefully gain more of their trust and gain more of their business over time.
Huh. That's interesting. You mentioned interest rates. How much attention do you pay to the macro? Is what the Federal Reserve is doing impact how you adjust your portfolios? Do you think about the state of economy, or is all that stuff background and you focus on finding companies at the right valuations?
So I'll talk about Wellington, and then I'll talk about Jean and how I incorporate interest rates and what is happening at the macro level. So we have half of our business is fixed income. So what happens on the Federal Reserve or the European government is critical to investing in fixed income. So it's a very important part of our dialogue at the firm. We have a very strong macro research effort at Wellington to help support both our equity as well as our fixed income and credit, fixed income rates investors as well as our credit investors. With their investment. So for the firm, macro investing is very important. I would say for myself as a healthcare investor, I probably would lean more that fundamentals, and we talked about healthcare, what's happening. I would spend most of my time thinking about what's happening with mechanism of action or how cancer is going to be cured. That's the most important thing to get right. But I found it very important over my career to make sure that you're focused on the macro. And there are probably two macro things. One would be what's happening in regulations around the world, regulatory bodies, what's happening in politics. That's a big, important macro effort for us in terms of understanding what could influence healthcare fundamentals. And then secondly would be what's happening with interest rates, because biopharmaceutical stocks are long dated. You're looking so far into the future in terms of how you think about earning streams. So, making sure that's part of the process in terms of valuations and how much you want to pay for those long dated assets. It's part of the equation that is very necessary to think about when constructing portfolios.
I have to ask you a little bit about some of the craziness we've seen in the market this past month. We had GameStop going wild, but we've also seen a little bit of frothy activity in Bitcoin and Tesla. What are your thoughts on the question of, is this just pockets of froth, or are we looking at a more significant bubble?
I guess the observation I would have is that we're 12 years into a bull market. Valuations are higher than they have been, and that's partly due to the low interest rates that we talked about, the Fed policy around the world. So, again, making sure we know the future direction of interest rates will be very important to valuations. I'm not the expert on Tesla or other areas, but I do observe that some parts of my investment universe, that the relationship between growth and valuation is at extremes, and some parts of that, not, you know, certainly most parts of it, are at very attractive valuations. So I guess as a value investor, that's just a very interesting relationship to me that I'm watching very closely.
So I think of the CEO role as a full-time job. I would also imagine running a $51 billion healthcare portfolio as a full-time job. You're going to continue managing the Vanguard healthcare funds. That seems like a lot to do at once. How are you going to juggle the two?
A couple of things. One, number one, we have named a president. My managing partner colleague Steve Klar will be president, so he will be a partner with me in terms of running parts of the organization. So that would be number one. Number two, I'm really believe in empowering the leaders, and so we have a management team both in terms of running the business as well as running our regional offices. Very excited about our leadership team, and that's a group of about 20 people. So that would be an observation number two. And then I would say, in terms of as observation number three, specifically for healthcare, you know, we have expanded the team over the last number of years. The team has matured in both their research and risk taking skills. So again, I'm going to be able to leverage that 15 person plus team very significantly as I go forward. And then maybe the last, just the last thing to share with you, Barry, is that one of the things that, and I think this is very specific, but one of maybe my super strengths is that I'm very organized. And again, making sure, and I've spent a lot of time thinking through how I'm going to spend my time going forward. And again, then it's up to me to execute that plan to make sure that I'm both spending significant time on managing healthcare assets for the Vanguard shareholders as well as the firm and all the clients of the firm. And so I feel very comfortable in the plan going forward and how I'm going to be spending my time. And then just hopefully there are benefits. The benefits of it will be that I'm going to be staying very close to our investors. I'm going to be, you know, we're going to be in the morning meeting together. We're going to be in company meetings together. And so staying close to investors hopefully will help me think about how we're going to evolve as investors. How are we going to use more science? How are we going to use more technology to help us evolve? So again, there's synergies to both the roles. And I think if we hopefully at the end of my term at Wellington as CEO, that we'll look back and say that was a benefit, that, you know, that was a benefit both to the firm as well as to Vanguard shareholders.
So let me throw a curveball at you. Gene becomes CEO, and then Gene notices the manager of the Vanguard Healthcare Fund is falling behind prior performance. How are you going to fire that manager? What are you going to do swapping hats that way?
So, we talked about governance, and our fiduciary responsibility at Wellington is another area that we take very seriously. And so we have a plan in place. So first of all, it will be Vanguard's responsibility to decide, you know, how well of a job I'm doing. So Vanguard will be the ultimate decision maker there. And then for myself, we have it's very important that we have fiduciary oversight of me as an investor as well. And so we have a plan in place to make sure that happens.
Makes sense. I assume that there was some mechanism that you guys weren't just spitballing, not with that much money. So let's jump to our favorite questions that we ask all of our guests, starting with what are you streaming these days? Tell us what's keeping you entertained, either Netflix or podcasts, or what are you doing for entertainment at home?
So one of the things, Barry, you may or may not know that I have four daughters, and so they're in their early 20s and late teens, and so I've been pretty busy over the last 22 plus years. And so one of the things I'm streaming now is these series that I never got to watch as I was working full time and raising a family. And so I watched West Wing. 2020 was a big West Wing year for me. I'd never watched the series, so that would be one. And then this British series, Bridgerton, that was a big series with my daughters over the holidays. We binge watched that when they were all home.
Yeah, that's funny. It's always interesting to see what people go back to. We never saw Mad Men, and we ended up just watching that. Very interesting period piece, just like West Wing. Tell us about your early mentors who helped to shape your career.
Well, we already talked about Ed. I would say, Ed was just so vital, someone that I worked alongside with for 20 years. And I again, back to Ed being just giving me the space to grow, the space to learn mistakes. So he was very critical. There's another person, Phil Perlmutter, who was one of the managing partners. He was a managing partner. He's since retired. He's recently retired from Wellington. But I would consider him a sponsor. He was always looking out for me. He was a mid-cap growth portfolio manager. So I guess I was helping him, but he was always making sure that my career was moving along.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
Let's talk about what you're reading these days. Tell us about some of your favorite books and what you're reading now.
So I really like historical fiction, where you learn about a place or a time through fiction. So I think my favorite book this year was Educated. I am on my bedstand right now. I have Barack Obama's book. So that's my next book to read in the coming months.
Sounds good. What sort of advice would you give to a recent college graduate who was interested in a career in either stock research or asset management or working in finance?
I would give two pieces of advice. One would be always be learning. So when I observe talent at Wellington, I get very excited about the talent at Wellington. The ones with this growth mindset that are always learning, always challenging the status quo of how we do things. Just very exciting to see. So again, always have that curiosity, growth mindset. Always thinking about what more could you be doing in your role. So that would be an important piece of advice. And then secondly, just that the asset management industry and research in terms of researching stocks, and it's just such a great business. And so I would encourage people graduating from college to think about the asset management industry. And again, there's a significant broader purpose here in terms of serving individuals and beneficiaries all over the world to help them lead better lives long term. And so how do we attract talent to that mission? We're allocating capital to companies that are going to make the vaccines that save, that really get us back, that save the world and protect the world. I think that is the kind of mission that I'd like to make sure that everyone knows, and just how exciting it is to be to meet companies and to meet heads of R&D and to meet CEOs and see how they're changing the future of the world. That is just as intellectually. I never have the Sunday night that I don't want to go to work the next day. It's just such a great business to be in.
Quite interesting. And our final question, what do you know about the world of investing today that you wish you knew 30 years ago when you were first getting started?
I think about the world of investing, I think about it in three phases, and we talked about being a deep researcher, being an investor, and I take being an investor meaning to, can you do recommended, can you take all your research insights and make recommendations? And then finally, being a risk taker and taking risk in portfolios. I guess if I had to know back 30 years, it probably would have been really perfecting each stage and getting maybe more training. I think that's one of the things we're really focused on at Wellington, is making sure we're training during those pivot points. So that would be one thing. You know, these are skills you can learn and skills that you can get better at with development. And so that's a very important initiative on my part in terms of how do we develop investors along that path. And then I think, you know, personally, just being very flexible, pivoting when you have new information, that's, I think, really hard. It's hard to do after you might have invested 2 or 3 years into a stock and then something changes. That ability to be flexible and pivot, I think, is critical to investment success. And, you know, the earlier you can learn that, the better.
Terrific stuff. Thanks, Jean, for being so generous with your time. We have been speaking with Jean Hines. She manages the $51 billion Vanguard Healthcare Fund and is the incoming CEO at Wellington Management, which runs over $1 trillion in client assets. If you enjoyed this conversation, well, be sure and check out any of the previous 387 prior such conversations we've had over the past 7 years. You can find them at iTunes, Spotify, wherever you feed your podcast fix. We love your comments, feedback, and suggestions. Write to us at mibpodcast@bloomberg.net. Give us a review on Apple iTunes. You can sign up for my daily reads at ritholtz.com. Check out my weekly column on bloomberg.com/opinion. Follow me on Twitter at ritholtz. I would be remiss if I did not thank the crack staff that helps us put together these conversations each and every week. Reggie Bazile is our audio engineer. Michael Boyle is my producer/booker. Atika Valbrun is our project manager. Michael Batnick is our head of research. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You've been listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for the Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.